Beak. In the dark, smoky kitchen, short Cocha Maria stood on her toes and iced the tall, double-deckered, welcome home our Sophie Moll cake. Though even in those days, most Syrian Christian women had started wearing saris, Cocha Maria still wore her spotless, half-sleeved white chatta with a V-neck and her white munna, which folded into a crisp cloth fan on her behind. Cocha Maria's fan was more or less hidden by the blue and white checked, frilled, absurdly incongruous housemaid's apron that Mamachi insisted she wear inside the house. She had short, thick forearms, fingers like cocktail sausages, and a broad, fleshy nose with flared nostrils. Deep folds of skin connected her nose to either side of her chin and separated that section of her face from the rest of it, like a snout. Her head was too large for her body. She looked like a bottled fetus that had escaped from its jar of formaldehyde in a biology lab, and unshriveled and thickened with age. She kept damp cash in her bodice, which she tied tightly around her chest to flatten her unchristian breasts. Her kunika earrings were thick and gold. Her earlobes had been distended into weighted loops that swung around her neck, her earrings sitting in them like gleeful children in a merry-go, not all the way round. Her right lobe had split open once and was sewn together again by Dr. Verghese Verghese. Cocha Maria couldn't stop wearing her kunika, because if she did, how would people know that, despite her lowly cook's job, 75 rupees a month, she was a Syrian Christian Marthamite? Not a Pelea, or Pulea, or a Paravan, but a touchable, upper-caste Christian, into whom Christianity had seeped like tea from a teabag. Split lobes stitched back were a better option by far. Cocha Maria hadn't yet made her acquaintance with the television addict waiting inside her, the Hulk Hogan addict. She hadn't yet seen a television set. She wouldn't have believed television existed. Had someone suggested that it did, Cocha Maria would have assumed that he or she was insulting her intelligence. Cocha Maria was wary of other people's versions of the outside world. More often than not, she took them to be a deliberate affront to her lack of education and earlier gullibility. In a determined reversal of her inherent nature, Cocha Maria now, as a policy, hardly ever believed anything that anybody said. A few months ago, in July, when Rahel told her that an American astronaut called Neil Armstrong had walked on the moon, she laughed sarcastically and said that a Malayali acrobat called O Muthachan had done handsprings on the sun, with pencils up his nose. She was prepared to concede that Americans existed, though she'd never seen one. She was even prepared to believe that Neil Armstrong might conceivably even be some absurd kind of name. But the walking on the moon bit? No, sir. Nor did she trust the vague grey pictures that had appeared in the Malayala Manorama that she couldn't read. She remained certain that Esther, when he said, "Et tu, Cocha Maria," was insulting her in English. She thought it meant something like, "Cocha Maria, you ugly black dwarf." She bided her time, waiting for a suitable opportunity to complain about him. She finished icing the tall cake. Then she tipped her head back and squeezed the leftover icing onto her tongue. Endless coils of chocolate toothpaste on a pink Cocha Maria tongue. When Mamachi called from the veranda, "Cocha Maria, I hear the car." Her mouth was full of icing and she couldn't answer. When she finished, she ran her tongue over her teeth and then made a series of short smacking sounds with her tongue against her palate, as though she'd just eaten something sour. Distant sky-blue car sounds, past the bus stop, past the school, past the yellow church, and up the bumpy red road through the rubber trees, sent a murmur through the dim, sooty premises of Paradise Pickles. The pickling, And the squashing, the slicing, boiling and stirring, the grating, salting, drying, the weighing and bottle sealing stopped. Chako sarvanu, the traveling whisper went. Chopping knives were put down, vegetables were abandoned, half cut on the huge steel platters. Desolate bitter gourds, incomplete pineapples. Colored rubber finger guards, bright, like cheerful thick condoms, were taken off. Pickled hands were washed and wiped on cobalt blue aprons. Escaped wisps of hair were recaptured and returned to white headscarves. Mundus tucked up under aprons were let down. The gauze doors of the factory had sprung hinges and closed noisily on their own. And on one side of the driveway, beside the old well, in the shade of the koromboli tree, a silent, blue-aproned army gathered in the green heat to watch. Blue-aproned, white-capped, like a clot of smart blue-and-white flags. Achu, Jos, Yako, Anian, Elayan, Kutten, Vijayan, Wawa, Joy, Sumati, Ammal, Annamma, Kanakamma, Lata, Sushila, Vijayamma, Jolikutti, Molikutti, Lusikutti, Beenamore. Girls with bus names. The early rumblings of discontent concealed under a thick layer of loyalty. The sky-blue Plymouth turned in at the gate and crunched over the gravel driveway, crushing small shells and shattering little red and yellow pebbles. Children tumbled out. Collapsed fountains, flattened puffs, crumpled yellow bell-bottoms and a go-go bag that was loved, jet-lagged and barely awake. Then the swollen-ankled adults, slow from too much sitting. "Have you arrived?" Mamachi asked, turning her slanty, dark glasses towards the new sounds, car doors slamming, getting outedness. She lowered her violin. "Mamachi," Rahel said to her beautiful, blind grandmother, "Esther vomited in the middle of the sound of music, and..." Amu touched her daughter gently, on her shoulder. And her touch meant, shh. Rahel looked around her and saw that she was in a play, but she had only a small part. She was just the landscape, a flower perhaps, or a tree, a face in the crowd, a townspeople. Nobody said hello to Rahel, not even the blue army in the green heat. "Where is she?" Mamachi asked the car sounds. "Where is my Sophie Moll? Come here and let me see you." As she spoke, the waiting melody that hung over her like a shimmering temple elephant's umbrella crumbled and gently fell about like dust. Chako, in his "What Happened to Our Man of the Masses" suit and well-fed tie, led Margaret Kochima and Sophie Moll triumphantly up the 9 red steps like a pair of tennis trophies that he had recently won. And once again, only the small things were said. The big things lurked unsaid inside. "Hello, Mamachi," Margaret Kochima said, in her kind schoolteacher that sometimes slapped voice. "Thank you for having us. We needed so much to get away." Mamachi caught a whiff of inexpensive perfume, soured at the edges by airline sweat. She herself had a bottle of Dior in its soft green leather pouch, locked away in her safe. Margaret Kochima took Mamachi's hand. The fingers were soft, the ruby rings were hard. "Hello, Margaret," Mamachi said. Not rude, not polite, her dark glasses still on. "Welcome to Imanam. I'm sorry I can't see you. As you must know, I am almost blind." She spoke in a slow, deliberate manner. "Oh, that's all right," Margaret Kochima said. "I'm sure I look terrible anyway." She laughed uncertainly, not sure if it was the right response. "Wrong," Chako said. He turned to Mamachi, smiling a proud smile that his mother couldn't see. "She's as lovely as ever." "I was very sorry to hear about Joe," Mamachi said. She sounded only a little sorry, not very sorry. There was a short, sad about Joe, silence. "Where's my Sophie Moll?" Mamachi said. Come here and let your grandmother look at you. Sophie Moll was led to Mamachi. Mamachi pushed her dark glasses up into her hair. They looked up like slanting cat's eyes at the moldy bison head. The moldy bison said, "No, absolutely not," in moldy bisonese. Even after her cornea transplant, Mamachi could only see light and shadow. If somebody was standing in the doorway, she could tell that someone was standing in the doorway, but not who it was. She could read a check, or a receipt, or a banknote, only if it was close enough for her eyelashes to touch it. She would then hold it steady and move her eye along it, wheeling it from word to word. The townspeople, in her fairy frock, saw Mamachi draw Sophie Moll close to her eyes to look at her, to read her like a check, to check her like a banknote. Mamachi, with her better eye, saw red-brown hair, almost blonde, the curve of two fat freckled cheeks, almost rosy, blue-gray-blue eyes. "Papachi's nose," Mamachi said. "Tell me, are you a pretty girl?" she asked Sophie Moll. "Yes," Sophie Moll said.
"And tall?"
"Tall for my age," Sophie Moll said.
"Very tall," Baby Kuchma said. "Much taller than Esther."
"She's older," Amu said.
"Still,"
Baby Kuchma said. A little way away, Renatha walked up the shortcut through the rubber trees, bare-bodied. A coil of insulated electrical wire was looped over one shoulder. He wore his printed dark blue and black munda, loosely folded, up above his knees. On his back, his lucky leaf from the birthmark tree that made the monsoons come on time. His autumn leaf at night. Before he emerged through the trees and stepped into the driveway, Rahel saw him and slipped out of the play and went to him. Amu saw her go. Offstage, she watched them perform their elaborate official greeting. Renatha curtsied, as he had been taught to, his munda spread like a skirt, like the English dairymaid in The King's Breakfast. Rahel bowed and said, "Bow." Then they hooked little fingers and shook hands gravely with the mien of bankers at a convention. In the dappled sunlight filtering through the dark green trees, Amu watched Renatha lift her daughter effortlessly as though she was an inflatable child made of air. As he tossed her up and she landed in his arms, Amu saw on Rahel's face the high delight of the airborne young. She saw the ridges of muscle on Renatha's stomach grow taut and rise under his skin like the divisions on a slab of chocolate. She wondered at how his body had changed so quietly from a flat-muscled boy's body into a man's body, contoured and hard, a swimmer's body, a swimmer-carpenter's body, polished with a high wax body polish. He had high cheekbones and a white, sudden smile. It was his smile that reminded Amu of Renatha as a little boy, helping Velyapapan to count coconuts, holding out little gifts he had made for her, flat on the palm of his hand, so that she could take them without touching him. Boats, boxes, small windmills, calling her Ammukutti, little Amu, though she was so much less little than he was. When she looked at him now, she couldn't help thinking that the man he had become bore so little resemblance to the boy he had been. His smile was the only piece of baggage he had carried with him from boyhood into manhood. Suddenly, Amu hoped that it had been him that Rahel saw in the march. She hoped it had been him that had raised his flag and knotted arm in anger. She hoped that under his careful cloak of cheerfulness, he housed a living, breathing anger against the smug, ordered world that she so raged against. She hoped it had been him. She was surprised at the extent of her daughter's physical ease with him, surprised that her child seemed to have a sub-world that excluded her entirely, a tactile world of smiles and laughter that she, her mother, had no part in.
Amu recognized vaguely that her thoughts were shot with a delicate purple tinge of envy. She didn't allow herself to consider who it was that she envied. The man? Or her own child? Or just their world of hooked fingers and sudden smiles? The man standing in the shade of the rubber trees with coins of sunshine dancing on his body, holding her daughter in his arms, glanced up and caught Amu's gaze. Centuries telescoped into one evanescent moment. History was wrong-footed, caught off guard, sloughed off like an old snakeskin. Its marks, its scars, its wounds from old wars, and the walking backward days all fell away. In its absence, it left an aura, a palpable shimmering that was as plain to see as the water in a river or the sun in the sky, as plain to feel as the heat on a hot day or the tug of a fish on a taut line, so obvious that no one noticed. In that brief moment, Relatha looked up and saw things that he hadn't seen before. Things that had been out of bounds so far, obscured by history's blinkers. Simple things. For instance, he saw that Rahel's mother was a woman. That she had deep dimples when she smiled, and that they stayed on long after her smile left her eyes. He saw that her brown arms were round and firm and perfect. That her shoulders shone, but her eyes were somewhere else. He saw that when he gave her gifts, they no longer needed to be offered flat on the palms of his hands so that she wouldn't have to touch him, his boats and boxes, his little windmills. He saw, too, that he was not necessarily the only giver of gifts. That she had gifts to give him, too. This knowing slid into him cleanly, like the sharp edge of a knife, cold and hot at once. It only took a moment. Amu saw that he saw. She looked away. He did too. History's fiends returned to claim them, to rewrap them in its old, scarred pelt, and drag them back to where they really lived. Where the love laws lay down who should be loved. And how? And how much? Amu walked up to the veranda, back into the play. Shaking. Relatha looked down at a Masada S insect in his arms. He put her down. Shaking, too.
"And look at you," he said, looking at her ridiculous frothy frock. "So beautiful, getting married."
Rahel lunged at his armpits and tickled him mercilessly. "Ickly, ickly, ickly."
"I saw you yesterday," she said.
"Where?"
Relatha made his voice high and surprised. "Liar," Rahel said. "Liar and pretender. I did see you. You were a communist and had a shirt and a flag. And you ignored me."
"Ayo kashtam,"
Relatha said. "Would I do that? You tell me, would Relatha ever do that? It must have been my long-lost twin brother."
"Which long-lost twin brother?"
"Urumban, silly. The one who lives in Kochi."
"Who, Urumban?"
Then she saw the twinkle.
"Liar! You haven't got a twin brother. It wasn't Urumban. It was you."
Relatha laughed. He had a lovely laugh that he really meant.
"Wasn't me," he said. "I was sick in bed."
"See, you're smiling," Rahel said. "That means it was you. Smiling means it was you."
"That's only in English," Relatha said. "In Malayalam, my teacher always said that smiling means it wasn't me."
It took Rahel a moment to sort that one out. She lunged at him once again. "Ickly, ickly, ickly." Still laughing, Relatha looked into the play for Sophie.
"Where's our Sophie Moll?
Let's take a look at her.
Did you remember to bring her, or did you leave her behind?"
"Don't look there," Rahel said urgently.
She stood up on the cement parapet that separated the rubber trees from the driveway and clapped her hands over Relatha's eyes.
"Why?"
Relatha said.
"Because,"
Rael said. I don't want you to.
Where's Estamon? Relatha said. With an ambassador, disguised as a stick insect, disguised as an airport fairy, hanging down his back with her legs wrapped around his waist, blindfolding him with her sticky little hands.
I haven't seen him.
Oh, we sold him in Cochin, Rael said airily. For a bag of rice. And a torch. The froth of her stiff frock pressed rough lace flowers into Relatha's back. Lace flowers and a lucky leaf bloomed on a black back. But when Rael searched the play for Esther, she saw that he wasn't there. Back inside the play, Cochimaria arrived, short, behind her tall cake. Cake's come, she said a little loudly to Mamachi. Cochimaria always spoke a little loudly to Mamachi because she assumed that poor eyesight automatically affected the other senses.
Kando, Cochimaria, Mamachi said. Can you see our Sophie Mall?
Kando, Cochima,
Cochimaria said extra loud. I can see her. She smiled at Sophie Mall, extra wide. She was exactly Sophie Mall's height. More short than Syrian Christian, despite her best efforts.
She has her mother's color, Cochimaria said.
Papachi's nose, Mamachi insisted.
I don't know about that, but she's very beautiful, Cochimaria shouted. Sundari Kutti, she's a little angel.
Little angels were beach-colored and wore bell-bottoms. Little demons were mud-brown, in airport fairy frocks, with forehead bumps that might turn into horns, with fountains in Love and Tokyos, and backwards reading habits. And if you cared to look, you could see Satan in their eyes. Cochimaria took both Sophie Mall's hands in hers, palms upward, raised them to her face, and inhaled deeply.
What's she doing?
Sophie Mall wanted to know, tender London hands clasped in calloused Imanum ones.
Who's she, and why is she smelling my hands?
She's the cook, Chaco said. That's her way of kissing you.
Kissing?
Sophie Mall was unconvinced, but interested.
How marvelous, Margaret Kochma said. It's a sort of sniffing. Do the men and women do it to each other, too?
She hadn't meant it to sound quite like that, and she blushed, an embarrassed, schoolteacher-shaped hole in the universe.
Oh, all the time, Amu said, and it came out a little louder than the sarcastic mumble that she had intended. That's how we make babies.
Chaco didn't slap her, so she didn't slap him back. But the waiting air grew angry. I think you owe my wife an apology, Amu, Chaco said, with a protective, proprietal air, hoping that Margaret Kochma wouldn't say ex-wife Chaco and wag a rose at him.
Oh, no, Margaret Kochma said. It was my fault. I never meant it to sound quite like that. What I meant was,
I mean, it is fascinating to think that it was a perfectly legitimate question, Chaco said, and I think Amu ought to apologize.
Must we behave like some damn godforsaken tribe that's just been discovered? Amu asked.
Oh dear, Margaret Kochma said.
In the angry quietness of the play, the blue army and the green heat still watching, Amu walked back to the Plymouth, took out her suitcase, slammed the door, and walked away to her room, her shoulders shining, leaving everybody to wonder where she had learned her effrontery from. And truth be told, it was no small wondering matter. Because Amu had not had the kind of education, nor read the sorts of books, nor met the sorts of people that might have influenced her to think the way she did. She was just that sort of animal. As a child, she had learned very quickly to disregard the Father Bear, Mother Bear story she was given to read. In her version, Father Bear beat Mother Bear with brass vases. Mother Bear suffered those beatings with mute resignation. In her growing years, Amu had watched her father weave his hideous web. He was charming and urbane with visitors, and stopped just short of fawning on them if they happened to be white. He donated money to orphanages and leprosy clinics. He worked hard on his public profile as a sophisticated, generous, moral man. But alone with his wife and children, he turned into a monstrous, suspicious bully with a streak of vicious cunning. They were beaten, humiliated, and then made to suffer the envy of friends and relations for having such a wonderful husband and father. Amu had endured cold winter nights in Delhi, hiding in the mehendi hedge around their house, in case people from good families saw them, because Papachi had come back from work out of sorts and beaten her and Mamachi and driven them out of their home. On one such night, Amu, aged 9, hiding with her mother in the hedge, watched Papachi's natty silhouette in the lit windows as he flitted from room to room. Not content with having beaten his wife and daughter, Chako was away at school, he tore down curtains, kicked furniture and smashed a table lamp. An hour after the lights went out, disdaining Mamachi's frightened pleading, little Amu crept back into the house through a ventilator to rescue her new gumboots that she loved more than anything else. She put them in a paper bag and crept back into the drawing room when the lights were suddenly switched on. Papachi had been sitting in his mahogany rocking chair all along, rocking himself silently in the dark. When he caught her, he didn't say a word. He flogged her with his ivory-handled riding crop, the one that he had held across his lap in his studio photograph. Amu didn't cry. When he finished beating her, he made her bring him Mamachi's pinking shears from her sewing cupboard. While Amu watched, the imperial entomologist shred her new gumboots with her mother's pinking shears. The strips of black rubber fell to the floor. The scissors made snicking scissor sounds. Amu ignored her mother's drawn, frightened face that appeared at the window. It took 10 minutes for her beloved gumboots to be completely shredded. When the last strip of rubber had rippled to the floor, her father looked at her with cold, flat eyes and rocked and rocked and rocked, surrounded by a sea of twisting rubber snakes. As she grew older, Amu learned to live with this cold, calculating cruelty. She developed a lofty sense of injustice and the mulish, reckless streak that develops in someone small who has been bullied all their lives by someone big. She did exactly nothing to avoid quarrels and confrontations. In fact, it could be argued that she sought them out, perhaps even enjoyed them. "Has she gone?" Mamachi asked the silence around her. "She's gone," Kochimaria said loudly. "Are you allowed to say damn in India?" Sophie Moll asked. "Who said damn?" Chako asked. "She did," Sophie Moll said. "Auntie Amu. She said some damn godforsaken tribe." "Cut the cake and give everybody a piece," Mamachi said. "Because in England we're not," Sophie Moll said to Chako. "Not what?" Chako said.
"Allowed to say D-A-M-N, Sophie Moll said.
Mamachi looked sightlessly out into the shining afternoon. "Is everyone here?" she asked. "Uwa Kochima," the blue army in the green heat said. "We're all here." Outside the play, Rahel said to Velitha, "We're not here, are we? We're not even playing." "That is exactly right," Velitha said. "We're not even playing. But what I would like to know is, where is our Esta Papi Chachan Kuttappan Peetamon?" And that became a delighted, breathless, Rumpelstiltskin-like dance among the rubber trees. "Oh, Esta Papi Chachan Kuttappan Peetamon, where, oh, where have you gone?" And from Rumpelstiltskin, it graduated to the Scarlet Pimpernel. "We seek him here, we seek him there, those Frenchies seek him everywhere. Is he in heaven? Is he in hell? That damn delusive Estepen." Kochimaria cut a sample piece of cake for Mamachi's approval. "One piece each," Mamachi confirmed to Kochimaria, touching the piece lightly with ruby-ringed fingers to see if it was small enough. Kochimaria sawed up the rest of the cake messily, laboriously, breathing through her mouth, as though she was carving a hunk of roast lamb. She put the pieces on a large silver tray. Mamaji played a Welcome Home, Our Sophie Moll melody on her violin, a cloying chocolate melody, sticky sweet and melty brown, chocolate waves on a chocolate shore. In the middle of the melody, Chaco raised his voice over the chocolate sound. Mama, he said, in his reading aloud voice. Mama, that's enough. Enough violin. Mamachi stopped playing and looked in Chaco's direction, the bow poised in midair. Enough? Do you think that's enough, Chaco? More than enough, Chaco said. Enough's enough, Mamachi murmured to herself. I think I'll stop now. As though the idea had suddenly occurred to her. She put her violin away into its black, violin-shaped box. It closed like a suitcase, and the music closed with it. Click and click. Mamachi put her dark glasses on again and drew the drapes across the hot day. Amu emerged from the house and called to Rahel. Rahel! I want you to have your afternoon nap. Come in after you've had your cake. Rahel's heart sank. Afternoon gnap. She hated those. Amu went back indoors. Relitha put Rahel down, and she stood forlornly at the edge of the driveway, on the periphery of the play, a gnap looming large and nasty on her horizon. And please stop being so over-familiar with that man, Baby Kuchma said to Rahel. Over-familiar? Mamaji said. Who is it, Chaco? Who's being over-familiar? Rahel, Baby Kuchma said. Over-familiar with who? With whom? Chaco corrected his mother. All right, with whom is she being over-familiar? Mamaji asked. Your beloved Velita, whom else? Baby Kuchma said, and to Chaco, ask him where he was yesterday. Let's bell the cat once and for all. Not now, Chaco said. What's over-familiar? Sophie Moll asked Margaret Kuchma, who didn't answer. Velita? Is Velita here? Are you here? Mamachi asked the afternoon. Uwa Kuchma. He stepped through the trees into the play. Did you find out what it was? Mamachi asked. The washer and the foot valve, Velita said. I've changed it. It's working now. Then switch it on, Mamachi said. The tank is empty. That man will be our nemesis, Baby Kuchma said. Not because she was clairvoyant and had had a sudden flash of prophetic vision, just to get him into trouble. Nobody paid her any attention. Mark my words, she said bitterly. See her? Kuchma Maria said when she got to Rahel with her tray of cake. She meant Sophie Moll. When she grows up, she'll be our Kuchma and she'll raise our salaries and give us nylon saris for ornam. Kuchma Maria collected saris, though she hadn't ever worn one and probably never would. So what? Rahel said. By then I'll be living in Africa. Africa? Kuchma Maria sniggered. Africa's full of ugly black people and mosquitoes. You're the one who's ugly, Rahel said, and added in English, stupid dwarf. What did you say? Kuchma Maria said threateningly. Don't tell me, I know, I heard. I'll tell Mamachi, just wait. Rahel walked across to the old well, where there were usually some ants to kill. Red ants, that had a sour, farty smell when they were squashed. Kuchma Maria followed her with a tray of cake. Rahel said she didn't want any of the stupid cake. Kushumbi, Kuchma Maria said. Jealous people go straight to hell. Who's jealous? I don't know, you tell me, Kuchma Maria said, with a frilly apron and a vinegar heart. Rahel put on her sunglasses and looked back into the play. Everything was angry-colored. Sophie Moll, standing between Margaret Kuchma and Chaco, looked as though she ought to be slapped. Rahel found a whole column of juicy ants. They were on their way to church, all dressed in red. They had to be killed before they got there, squished and squashed with a stone. You can't have smelly ants in church. The ants made a faint, crunchy sound as life left them. Like an elf eating toast. Or a crisp biscuit. The Antley church would be empty, and the Antley bishop would wait in his funny Antley bishop clothes, swinging frankincense in a silver pot.
and nobody would arrive. After he had waited for a reasonably antly amount of time, he would get a funny antly bishop frown on his forehead and shake his head sadly. He would look at the glowing antly stained glass windows, and when he finished looking at them, he would lock the church with an enormous key and make it dark. Then he'd go home to his wife, and if she wasn't dead, they'd have an antly afternoon gnap. Sophie Moll, hatted, bell-bottomed, and loved from the beginning, walked out of the play to see what Rahel was doing behind the well. But the play went with her, walked when she walked, stopped when she stopped. Fond smiles followed her. Kutcha Maria moved the cake tray out of the way of her adoring downward smile as Sophie squatted down in the well squelch. Yellow bottoms of bells, muddy wet now. Sophie Moll inspected the smelly mayhem with clinical detachment. The stone was coated with crushed red carcasses and a few feebly waving legs. Kutcha Maria watched with her cake crumbs. The fond smiles watched, fondly. Little girls playing. Sweet. One beach-colored, one brown. One loved a little less. Let's leave one alive so that it can be lonely, Sophie Moll suggested. Rahel ignored her and killed them all. Then, in her frothy airport frock with matching knickers, no longer crisp, and unmatching sunglasses, she ran away, disappeared into the green heat. The fond smiles stayed on Sophie Moll like a spotlight, thinking, perhaps, that the sweet cousins were playing hide-and-seek, like sweet cousins often do. Chapter 9. Mrs. Pillai, Mrs. Eapen, Mrs. Rajagopalan. The green for the day had seeped from the trees. Dark palm leaves were splayed like drooping combs against the monsoon sky. The orange sun slid through their bent, grasping teeth. A squadron of fruit bats sped across the gloom. In the abandoned ornamental garden, Rahel, watched by lolling dwarfs and a forsaken cherub, squatted by the stagnant pond and watched toads hop from stone to scummy stone. Beautiful, ugly toads. Slimy, warty, croaking. Yearning, unkissed princes trapped inside them. Food for snakes that lurked in the long June grass. Rustle, lunge. No more toad to hop from stone to scummy stone. No more prince to kiss. It was the first night since she'd come that it hadn't rained. Around now, Rahel thought, if this were Washington, I would be on my way to work. The bus ride. The street lights. The gas fumes. The shapes of people's breath on the bulletproof glass of my cabin. The clatter of coins pushed towards me in the metal tray. The smell of money on my fingers. The punctual drunk with sober eyes who arrives exactly at 10 p.m. Hey, you black bitch, suck my dick. She owned $700 and a gold bangle with snake heads. But Baby Kuchma had already asked her how much longer she planned to stay and what she planned to do about Esther. She had no plans. No plans. No locusts stand I. She looked back at the looming, gabled, house-shaped hole in the universe and imagined living in the silver bowl that Baby Kuchma had installed on the roof. It looked large enough for people to live in. Certainly it was bigger than a lot of people's homes. Bigger, for instance, than Kutcha Maria's cramped quarters. If they slept there, she and Esther, curled together like fetuses in a shallow steel womb, what would Hulk Hogan and Bam Bam Bigelow do? If the dish were occupied, where would they go? Would they slip through the chimney into Baby Kuchma's life and TV? Would they land on the old stove with a "Here!" in their muscles and spangled clothes? Would the thin people, the famine victims and refugees, slip through the cracks in the doors?
Would genocide slide between the tiles? The sky was thick with TV. If you wore special glasses, you could see them, spinning through the sky among the bats and homing birds. Blondes, wars, famines, football, food shows, coup d'etat, hairstyles stiff with hairspray. Designer pectorals, gliding towards Imanum like skydivers, making patterns in the sky, wheels, windmills, flowers blooming and unblooming.
Here!
Rahel returned to contemplating toads. Fat, yellow, from stone to scummy stone. She touched one gently. It moved its eyelids upwards, funnily self-assured. Nictitating membrane, she remembered she and Esther once spent a whole day saying, she and Esther and Sophie Moore. Nictitating, ictitating, titating, itating, tating, ating, ting, ing. They were, all three of them, wearing saris, old ones, torn in half that day. Esther was the draping expert. He pleated Sophie Moll's pleats, organized Rahel's pallu, and settled his own. They had red bindis on their foreheads. In the process of trying to wash out Amu's forbidden coal, they had smudged it all over their eyes, and on the whole looked like three raccoons trying to pass off as Hindu ladies. It was about a week after Sophie Moll arrived, a week before she died. By then she had performed unfalteringly under the twins' perspicacious scrutiny and had confounded all their expectations. She had, A, informed Chaco that even though he was her real father, she loved him less than Joe, which left him available, even if not inclined, to be the surrogate father of certain two-egg persons greedy for his affection. B, turned down Mamachi's offer that she replace Esther and Rahel as the privileged platter of Mamachi's nightly rat's tail and counter of moles. C, and most important, astutely gauged the prevailing temper, and not just rejected but rejected outright and extremely rudely, all of Baby Kuchma's advances and small seductions. As if this were not enough, she also revealed herself to be human. One day the twins returned from a clandestine trip to the river, which had excluded Sophie Moll, and found her in the garden in tears, perched on the highest point of Baby Kuchma's herb curl, being lonely, as she put it. The next day, Esther and Rahel took her with them to visit Relatha. They visited him in saris, clumping gracelessly through red mud and long grass, nictitating, ictitating, tating, ating, ting, ing, and introduced themselves as Mrs. Pirle, Mrs. Eepen, and Mrs. Rajagopalan. Relatha introduced himself and his paralyzed brother, Kuttappan, although he was fast asleep. He greeted them with the utmost courtesy. He addressed them all as Kochamma and gave them fresh coconut water to drink. He chatted to them about the weather, the river, the fact that in his opinion, coconut trees were getting shorter by the year. As were the ladies in Imanum. He introduced them to his surly hen. He showed them his carpentry tools and whittled them each a little wooden spoon. It is only now, these years later, that Rahel, with adult hindsight, recognized the sweetness of that gesture. A grown man entertaining three raccoons, treating them like real ladies, instinctively colluding in the conspiracy of their fiction, taking care not to decimate it with adult carelessness or affection. It is, after all, so easy to shatter a story, to break a chain of thought, to ruin a fragment of a dream being carried around carefully like a piece of porcelain. To let it be, to travel with it, as Velitha did, is much the harder thing to do. 3 days before the terror, he had let them paint his nails with red cutex that Amu had discarded. That's the way he was, the day history visited them in the back veranda, a carpenter with gaudy nails. The posse of touchable policemen had looked at them and laughed. "What's this?" one had said. "AC/DC?" Another lifted his boot with a millipede curled into the ridges of its sole, deep rust-brown, a million legs. The last strap of light slipped from the cherub's shoulder. Gloom swallowed the garden, whole, like a python. Lights came on in the house. Rahel could see Esther in his room, sitting on his neat bed. He was looking out through the barred window at the darkness. He couldn't see her, sitting outside in the darkness, looking in at the light. A pair of actors, trapped in a recondite play with no hint of plot or narrative, stumbling through their parts, nursing someone else's sorrow, grieving someone else's grief. Unable somehow to change plays, or purchase, for a fee, some cheap brand of exorcism from a counselor with a fancy degree who would sit them down and say, in one of many ways, "You're not the sinners. You're the sinned against. You were only children. You had no control. You are the victims, not the perpetrators." It would have helped if they could have made that crossing. If only they could have worn, even temporarily, the tragic hood of victimhood. Then they would have been able to put a face on it, and conjure up fury at what had happened, or seek redress, and eventually, perhaps, exorcise the memories that haunted them. But anger wasn't available to them, and there was no face to put on this other thing that they held in their sticky, other hands, like an imaginary orange. There was nowhere to lay it down. It wasn't theirs to give away. It would have to be held, carefully, and forever. Estepan and Rahel both knew that there were several perpetrators besides themselves that day, but only one victim. And he had blood-red nails and a brown leaf on his back that made the monsoons come on time. He left behind a hole in the universe through which darkness poured like liquid tar, through which their mother followed without even turning to wave goodbye. She left them behind, spinning in the dark with no moorings, in a place with no foundation. Hours later, the moon rose and made the gloomy python surrender what it had swallowed. The garden reappeared, regurgitated whole, with Rahel sitting in it. The direction of the breeze changed and brought her the sound of drums. A gift, the promise of a story. Once upon a time, they said, there lived a... Rahel lifted her head and listened. On clear nights, the sound of the chenda traveled up to a kilometer from the Imanam temple, announcing a Kathakali performance. Rahel went, drawn by the memory of steep roofs and white walls, of brass lamps lit and dark, oiled wood. She went in the hope of meeting an old elephant who wasn't electrocuted on the Kottayam Cochin Highway. She stopped by the kitchen for a coconut. On her way out, she noticed that one of the gauze doors of the factory had come off its hinges and was propped against the doorway. She moved it aside and stepped in. The air was heavy with moisture, wet enough for fish to swim in. The floor under her shoes was slick with monsoon scum. A small anxious bat flitted between the roof beams. The low cement pickle vats, silhouetted in the gloom, made the factory floor look like an indoor cemetery for the cylindrical dead, the earthly remains of paradise pickles and preserves. Where long ago, on the day that Sophie Moore came, Ambassador E. Pelvis stirred a pot of scarlet jam and thought two thoughts. Where a red, tender mango-shaped secret was pickled, sealed, and put away. It's true. Things can change in a day. Chapter 10. The River in the Boat. While the Welcome Home Our Sophie Moore play was being performed in the front veranda, and Kochumaria distributed cake to a blue army in the green heat, Ambassador E. Pelvis / S. Pimpernel, with a puff of the beige and pointy shoes, pushed open the gauze doors to the dank and pickle-smelling premises of Paradise Pickles. He walked among the giant cement pickle vats to find a place to think in. Ausa, the bar Nowl, who lived on a blackened beam near the skylight and contributed occasionally to the flavor of certain Paradise products, watched him walk. Past floating yellow limes in brine that needed prodding from time to time, or else islands of black fungus formed like frilled mushrooms in a clear soup. Past green mangoes, cut and stuffed with turmeric and chili powder and tied together with twine. They needed no attention for a while. Past glass casks of vinegar with corks. Past shelves of pectin and preservatives. Past trays of bitter gourd with knives and colored finger guards. Past gunny bags, bulging with garlic and small onions. Past mounds of fresh green peppercorns. Past a heap of banana peels on the floor, preserved for the pig's dinner. Past the label cupboard full of labels. Past the glue. Past the glue brush. Past an iron tub of empty bottles floating in soap-bubbled water. Past the lemon squash, the grape crush, and back. It was dark inside, lit only by the light that filtered through the clotted gauze doors and a beam of dusty sunlight that Ausa didn't use from the skylight. The smell of vinegar and asafoetida stung his nostrils, but Esther was used to it, loved it. The place that he found to think in was between the wall and the black iron cauldron in which a batch of freshly boiled, illegal banana jam was slowly cooling. The jam was still hot, and on its sticky scarlet surface, thick pink froth was dying slowly. Little banana bubbles, drowning deep in jam, and nobody to help them. The orange drink, lemon drink man could walk in any minute, catch a Kutchinkotem bus and be there. And Amu would offer him a cup of tea. Or pineapple squash, perhaps, with ice. Yellow in a glass. With the long iron stirrer, Esther stirred the thick, fresh jam. The dying froth made dying frothly shapes. A crow with a crushed wing, a clenched chicken's claw, a Nowl, not Ausa, mired in sickly jam. A sadly swirl, and nobody to help. As Esther stirred the thick jam, he thought two thoughts, and the two thoughts he thought were these. A. Anything can happen to anyone. And B. It's best to be prepared. Having thought these thoughts, Esther alone was happy with his bit of wisdom. As the hot magenta jam went round, Esther became a stirring wizard, with a spoiled puff and uneven teeth, and then the witches of Macbeth. Fire burn, banana bubble. Amu had allowed Esther to copy Mamachi's recipe for banana jam into her new recipe book, Black with White Spine. Acutely aware of the honor that Amu had bestowed on him, Esther had used both his best handwritings. Banana jam, in his old best writing. Crush ripe banana. Add water to cover and cook on a very hot fire till fruit is soft. Squeeze out juice by straining through coarse muslin. Weigh equal quantity of sugar and keep by. Cook fruit juice till it turns scarlet and about half the quantity evaporates. Prepare the gelatin, pectin, thus. Proportion 1:5, that is 4 teaspoons pectin to 20 teaspoons sugar. Esther always thought of pectin as the youngest of three brothers with hammers, Pectin, Hectin, and Abednego. He imagined them building a wooden ship in failing light and a drizzle, like Noah's sons. He could see them clearly in his mind, racing against time, the sound of their hammering echoing dully under the brooding, storm-coming sky. And nearby in the jungle, in the eerie, storm-coming light, animals queued up in pairs, girl boy, girl boy, girl boy, girl boy. Twins were not allowed. The rest of the recipe was in Esther's new best handwriting. Angular, spiky, It leaned backwards, as though the letters were reluctant to form words, and the words reluctant to be in sentences. Add the pectin to concentrated juice. Cook for a few, 5 minutes. Use a strong fire, burning heavily all around. Add the sugar. Cook until sheeting consistency is obtained. Cool slowly. Hope you will enjoy this recipe. Apart from the spelling mistakes, the last line, "Hope you will enjoy this recipe," was Esther's only augmentation of the original text. Gradually, as Esther stirred, the banana jam thickened and cooled, and thought number 3 rose unbidden from his beige and pointy shoes. Thought number 3 was, sea. A boat. A boat to row across the river. Akara, the other side. A boat to carry provisions, matches, clothes, pots and pans, things they would need and couldn't swim with. Esther's arm hairs stood on end. The jam stirring became a boat rowing. The round and round became a back and forth. Across a sticky, scarlet river. A song from the Ornum boat race filled the factory. Te de tagade de dom.
Endada korngacha chandi itre teinyada.
Hey, Mr. Monkey Man, why is your bum so red?
Pandiyil thooran poyappol, nerakamuthri nerangi njan.
I went for a shit to Madras and scraped it till it bled. Over the somewhat discourteous questions and answers of the boat song, Rahel's voice floated into the factory.
Esther! Esther! Esther!
Esther didn't answer. The chorus of the boat song was whispered into the thick jam.
Teyom tittom taraka tittom team.
The gauze door creaked, and an airport ferry with horn bumps and yellow-rimmed red plastic sunglasses looked in, with the sun behind her. The factory was angry-colored. The salted limes were red. The tender mangoes were red. The label cupboard was red. The dusty sunbeam, that Ausa never used, was red. The gauze door closed. Rahel stood in the empty factory with her fountain in a love in Tokyo. She heard a nun's voice singing the boat song, a clear soprano wafting over vinegar fumes and pickle vats. She turned to Esther, bent over the scarlet broth in the black cauldron.
What do you want? Esther asked without looking up.
Nothing, Rahel said.
Then why have you come here?
Rahel didn't reply. There was a brief, hostile silence.
Why are you rowing the jam? Rahel asked.
India's a free country, Esther said. No one could argue with that. India was a free country. You could make salt. Row jam if you wanted to. The orange drink, lemon drink man could just walk in through the gauze doors if he wanted to. And Amu would offer him pineapple juice with ice. Rahel sat on the edge of a cement vat. Frothy ends of buckram and lace, delicately dipped in tender mango pickle, and tried on the rubber finger guards. 3 blue bottles fiercely fought the gauze doors, wanting to be let in, and Ausa, the bar Naul, watched the pickle-smelling silence that lay between the twins like a bruise. Rahel's fingers were yellow, green, blue, red, yellow. Esther's jam was stirred. Rahel got up to go. For her afternoon gnap.
Where are you going?
Somewhere. Rahel took off her new fingers and had her old finger-colored fingers back. Not yellow, not green, not blue, not red, not yellow.
I'm going to Akara, Esther said, not looking up.
To the history house.
Rahel stopped and turned around, and on her heart, a drab moth, with unusually dense dorsal tufts, unfurled its predatory wings. Slow out, slow in.
Why? Rahel said.
Because anything can happen to anyone, Esther said.
It's best to be prepared.
You couldn't argue with that.
Nobody went to Karisaip's house anymore. Velipapan claimed to be the last human being to have set eyes on it. He said that it was haunted. He had told the twins